The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On the show this week...
In Iceland itself, you had about one-fifth of the country died. You only had about 50,000 people in the whole country at the time, and 10,000 of them died. It's one of sort of the major events in Icelandic history that's kind of seared into the country's psyche.
I speak to Alexandra Witsi and Jeff Knipe about their new book, Island on Fire, the story of the Icelandic volcano Laki, its role in turning 18th century Europe dark, and why Iceland's volcanoes might cause trouble in the future. Also, we look at some of this week's more noteworthy science stories, including research into how men in lab coats stress rodents in cages, how synesthesia can aid memory, and what funding cuts mean for science at Kew Gardens in London. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. To lend their wit and wisdom to this week's news discussion, I'm joined by nature writer and podcast presenter Kerry Smith. Welcome to the pod, Kerry.
Thanks for having me.
And by Observer Tech Monthly commissioning editor Nicola Davis. Welcome, Nicola.
Hi there.
Okay, we'll kick off with your story, Kerry, about men stressing mice. What's all that about?
Yeah, so scientists are always trying to avoid bias in whenever they do experiments. They might take some mice, which are a very common model for scientists doing work, and feed them the same food or do an experiment at the same time of day. And this new study from the journal Nature Methods reports that the people who do the experiments on the mice can affect their behaviour. And if a male experimenter specifically is doing the test, then the mice get more stressed.
And so what are the implications for results? I mean, do you have to just look at particular studies and say, okay, these ones, we know that they're going to be a little bit unreliable or what?
Well, the question is, how do you know afterwards? So the authors of the study say, well, from now on, people should try and account for the gender of the experimenter when they write their methods sections of their papers so that we'll know if the mice were more stressed, then, you know, could it be a result of all the experimenters being male, half of them being... But there could be a lot of implications of this kind of effect.
And you say it doesn't happen if the person is a female wearing a lab coat?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, what they're wearing and is this a visual thing. It turns out to be kind of a pheromone thing. It's an olfactory that the mice are smelling the difference between a male and a female. And they actually did a nice little control study where, so first of all, they had men go and sit in the room with the mice, then females, and they made sure what the difference, you know, whether they could see a difference there. And then they got males and females to wear a T-shirt overnight for at least 8 hours. And then they just put the T-shirts of each gender in the room with the mice, and again the male t-shirts made a difference, the female t-shirts didn't.
How big an effect is it? I mean, is it enough to is it statistically significant in the study to affect things that we've taken from mice studies in the past?
It's certainly significant enough for them to, you know, to have considered writing a whole paper about it. And their results look pretty convincing. They measured a few different indicators of the stress in mice. They measured their stress hormone levels. They measured how much they kind of clung to the walls as they roamed around their little enclosures. And they measured how much pain they felt, because actually under stress, mice and humans, I think, for that matter, feel a bit less pain. It's called stress-induced analgesia. So they had a measure of that as well. And again, the males being present made the mice more stressed and feel less pain as a result.
Wow.
Is this just another sort of reason why mice are becoming, seem to be less and less reliable in lab experiments when you're trying to do something which might be relevant to humans?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that we don't take into account that we probably should. I mean, this seems like a really basic variable, quite easy to account for, actually. Just maybe get females to do your studies, put a female T-shirt in the room, maybe, while your male experimenter is doing his studies, or at least just tell people about it afterwards. But there could be a whole host of other factors that we're not taking into account. And you know, we could talk for a long time about other reasons why mouse models of human diseases aren't very effective. I mean, how do you model autism or schizophrenia in a mouse?
What role do mice models have in the future of medical research? Presumably we're not going to ditch mice overnight, but there are obviously limitations. So is there one kind of area of research that they are perhaps more suited to than others?
There are certainly ways in which they're more or less similar to humans. And with this particular result in mind, you know, maybe maybe it turns out that we need to take more things into account when we're looking at stress behavior in mice or pain, or but there are certain conditions where that might not affect how they behave. Like if you're studying obesity and you're just feeding them and they don't care about who feeds them the food, then you know you can continue to do that work without necessarily worrying too much. And you know, we're certainly going to need mouse models to do science. There's no question that they have a place.
Bad news for anxiety research. Are humans affected by the sex of the experimenter?
There have been indications that they are. So, and this paper relates to pain. In studies of humans and pain thresholds and that sort of thing, if a female experimenter is doing the measuring of a male's pain threshold, the man is more likely to underestimate it, to say that it's lower than if a male administers that test. And for females, it makes no difference whether it's a male or a female nurse, for example, administering the test.
So do you think they genuinely underestimate it, or they just play it down because they want to be more stoic?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's probably not a biological phenomenon as much as a kind of emotional one, maybe, or it's just a bit of machismo, probably.
Yeah.
So that's probably not what's happening in these mice, but who knows? We didn't ask them.
Once more, we need to rewrite the science books. That story is in Nature Methods, but to read more of Nature's science, go to nature.com/news. Richard Feynman had it, Vladimir Nabokov had it, heck, even Tori Amos has it. Synesthesia is a neurological condition where stimulation of one sensory or cognitive pathway triggers automatic and involuntary sensory information in another cognitive pathway, most commonly words or sounds and colours. Although it's estimated that only one in every 2,000 people have synesthesia, researchers seem to think that we all stand to gain if we can become a little bit more synesthetic ourselves. Nicola, is this true?
Well, this is a story that was in Discover, which was in The Observer yesterday, in fact. And it's a nice story by Helen Massey Beresford about how scientists are trying to get those of us without synesthesia to kind of pick up some of the benefits of synesthesia by sort of trying to get us to recreate it ourselves. So actually, it said that about 4.4% of adults have some form of synesthesia. And the most common is called grapheme colour synesthesia, which is where you link, where you see colours associated with certain letters or words. And this is one of the types of synesthesia that they're looking at. And what they're trying to do is to artificially induce people without synesthesia to associate colours with words. And they think that this might be useful in helping people who are perhaps suffering from memory problems, perhaps people with conditions like Alzheimer's, to help to improve their memory and help to improve their recall.
And it's the kind of connections they're trying to make, sort of very obvious ones, like having the word cold look blue and things like that. Or are they kind of trying to do this?
Yeah, that's about right. So they get people to sit in front of a screen and they give them different coloured words and they try to get them to remember those coloured words and then do memory tests on them to see how that's working out. And it's very early days because only sort of, you know, 10, 15 years ago, if you said you had this effect, people kind of didn't believe you. Mm, and it's been a lot of work since then showing that actually this is a real effect. People do see colours, or there are lots of other effects as well. I mean, you have ones, for example, where certain words have tastes. So if you say, as Helen tells us, if you say the word London, people might sort of get a taste of strawberry going on in their mouth. So it's sort of quite interesting, the effects that you can get. There's also this mirror touch synesthesia, which is where if you see someone being touched, you feel like you're being touched as well. So it's sort of lots of different ways this could manifest itself. And what's interesting is that in this article, she talks about how one of the academics she talks to explains that we all have, in a very, very low level, some of these associations. So she says that if you really push people, you'll find that more common letters we associate with brighter colours. But it's not something that you would initially think that you do. But so it's sort of like a heightened sensitivity to that.
And have they shown any benefit from doing this, or are they just starting to see if people with early stage dementia or what have you benefit from this kind of connection with a word and memory and colour?
Well, so far it seems to be pretty early stages, and it seems to be more about taking people who don't have Alzheimer's and seeing whether it improves their memory. What's interesting, so it's a bit like a mnemonic in a way, you know, it's like a memory aid. But what they don't know is that you can get people to sort of associate a word or letters with colours. But whether you're truly recreating what a synesthete experiences or not is going to be a bit trickier to ascertain. And then which of these elements is important? Is it the fact that you're associating a word with a colour, or is it that you have to have that particular experience? This is all stuff that seems to be very much in research at the moment.
It seems like it might be quite distracting to have a colour arbitrarily associated with a letter or a word, and then it comes up in a different scenario and actually it turns out not to be very helpful that C is blue anymore.
Well, it could be useful if you're particularly trying to learn one particular thing, a bit like if you're doing, I don't know, revision or whatever. You know, people would often use sort of coloured pens and things like that. So it's sort of tricks that people are trying already, I would imagine, trying to use. But as you say, in a general sense, how useful it will be.
And do people get extra sensations from sounds?
Yeah, so there are different ones. You have music colour synesthesia. You can have things like touch and colour, where different textures generate different colours as well. There seems to be a huge number of different combinations of these. So it's not one type, but the most common type is the one which associates colour with words or letters.
Some of it sounds like really enriching. I don't want to belittle the condition, and it must be, I'm sure for some people it's really annoying, but some of it that I'm actually quite envious of them, apart from the one about when other people are being touched, that you feel like you're being touched, that could get a bit troubling.
I think people really like it. Studies that have been done with synesthetes as participants, where they wouldn't part with it for the world, and actually they don't realise for 20 years that they have this condition that no one else has. And actually probably using the word condition makes it sound like a disorder.
Yeah,
doesn't it?
I feel bad about that. Maybe us that's lacking
it's
it.
It's kind of a benefit.
For that story and all the rest of the Observer's science coverage, just go to theguardian.com/science. The story I was going to talk about was the fuss over the cuts at Kew Gardens, which is the Royal Botanic Gardens in London. It's one of the world's premier places for botanic research, and also a spectacular sort of visitor attraction. It's UNESCO World Heritage Site. They get about 2 million visitors a year, and they have the world's largest plant collection. Now, down in West Sussex, they also have the Millennium Seed Bank, where they're trying to gather together a lot of specimens from different plants around the world to preserve them for biodiversity and breeding purposes. Now, a lot of fuss over the cuts has been that they face a £5 million hole in their budget this year, which means that although they can make some of that money up by improving and growing their income, they are going to lose about 125 jobs. Now, we've been doing a little bit of digging on this, and it looks like the science is going to take the brunt of those jobs. About 40 to 50 science posts are going to go. The rest will go from corporate services and something called public programs, of very few others from the other areas of Kew. And there is an enormous fuss going on with this. And there's a petition which is over 70,000 people saying that DEFRA, the main funder in government, should be upping its funding for the site, because it's just such a national treasure. But it's interesting. I found a report that was done, that DEFRA actually commissioned, that was published in 2010, which specifically recommended that DEFRA keep up its funding for Kew. Otherwise, its future was at risk. And by future, I mean its sort of world-class status as this scientific institution. And DEFRA clearly hasn't done that. It's been cutting Kew's operating budget. They have been giving them a lot of money to refurbish their buildings, though. So this site has an enormous number, about 40-odd fantastic buildings, and one of them is the largest Victorian glass structure that remains in the world. But it's costing over £30 million to refurbish that place over 5 years. Part of the reason it's so expensive is that Kew let it get in a real state by not doing any work on it for 30 years. So there's a bit of blame on either side. But I was talking to the director, and he's playing down the damage and saying that, you know, that there's been some hysterical responses over this, that Kew Science will be going under, and that, you know, it's the end of the road for them, which he says isn't true at all. And what he's saying is they're going to prioritise science from which they can make money. So that means the sort of grants they can get, but also teaching and education programmes that they can spin out from that science. And they are going to have to trim back on some other areas of science. And some people you speak to say that's awful. But others will say, well, you know, they were spreading themselves too thinly already. They were trying to do too many projects. And that would be a good thing to do, that it's long overdue that they streamlined it and narrowed down their focus.
So the amount that they're actually losing as a result of government cuts is about 1.5 million over the next coming 3 years.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, to put that into context, how, you know, it's difficult for us to imagine. I mean, it's difficult, I would imagine, for us all to think about 1.5 million. It sounds like a hell of a lot of money to an individual. Put it in context for us. How much is that for an institution?
Well, what I can do is for their... As you say, the hole they've got in their budget at least is 5 million. Only 1.5 of that is due to the decline in DEFRA funding. So 2 million comes from just their own foundation, their own money-raising foundation, which is like this arm's-length body. It cannot bail out Q anymore. It goes away, it makes money, and it gives it all to Q. And for the last 2 years, it's been giving more than it should have done. So 2 million are lost that way. The remaining part of that budget hole comes from rises in salaries that are just automatic, and also their incredible energy bill. Their gas and electricity is like £1.4 million. How it fits into their overall grant, I mean, they get sort of 16, 17, I forget the full figure, million a year as an operating grant. And then they get a whack on top of that, but that's very sporadic for capital stuff when the capital grants are for looking after these buildings, basically. What Q will say is that it's the operating grant that matters in terms of running the place, and that has been going down. Many thanks to Nicola and Kerry there, and for links to all the articles discussed this week, just go to theguardian.com/scienceweekly. In Europe, I think it's fair to say volcanoes inspire little more than curiosity or a benign sense of frustration when ash plumes disrupt air travel, which is what happened in 2010 when Iceland's least pronounceable volcano, Eyjafjallajökull, spewed an estimated 25 million cubic metres of ash into the air and created airport chaos across Europe for weeks. But this troublesome Icelandic volcano is just one of many on an island which is defined by its volcanic history. In a new book, Island on Fire, geologist Alex Whitsey and science writer Jeff Knipe tell the story of Iceland's Laki volcano, which has a special place in European history. When I met up with them both, I started by asking Alex to give us a sense of how dramatic this volcanic landscape is.
So if you drive Iceland, if you drive the ring road around the island, like a lot of tourists do, you'll see nothing but lava the whole way. Great towering cliffs, huge expanses of lava. In places there are farms, so there's patches and patches of green where people are growing stuff on this rich volcanic soil. When you get closer to Laki, what you start to see is a rolling landscape, a very eerie landscape where the lava has formed this kind of rolling features. You look across and all you see is sort of bumps and hollows and swathes. And the Icelandic moss, which is this incredible sort of grayish-green fuzziness, has covered it. So it looks, Jeff has said before, it looks like someone has thrown about a million throw pillows down, and they're just tumbled all around with this very irregular surface that's soft and grayish and mossy. And to get to Laki itself, you start driving across this landscape for many, many hours. So you get in one of these four-wheel drive vans with massive tires, and you drive through rivers and across lava, and up and down and up and down. And after a number of hours, you sort of come to a long, long ridge. It looks like a long, low mountain in the horizon, but the closer you get, it resolves into these individual craters. You see little cinder cones all lined up, marching like one after the other, like gumdrops almost across into the horizon, off to the ice caps in the distance. And that is the Laki crater row.
Just on the basics of Iceland, why is it simply that there are so many volcanoes there?
Yeah, so there's two reasons Iceland has so many volcanoes. One is it's on what's called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, right? So that's most of the time, that's an underwater seafloor area, the seafloor ridge where new magma is welling up from below and new seafloor is being born and spreading away on either side. Iceland's the only place where this volcanic ridge actually rises across the water. Anyone who's been a tourist to Iceland has probably gone to this very, very famous site called Þingvellir, which is where the first parliament was held around 930 AD. And that's where, literally within the rift, you can stand there and look at these massive cliffs where Eurasia's pulling apart from one direction and North America pulling apart on the other. The other reason Iceland has so many volcanoes is there's also a hot spot of magma, a single what they call mantle plume, like a welder's torch from below, supplying another stream of magma up to the island from below. So both this ridge spreading and this hot spot from below combine to give it extra doses of magma.
So in the book, you focus particularly on this volcanic eruption from the 18th century at Laki. You were talking a bit about that. Tell us about Lucky, is it a town still? Are there people there? But why pick on that eruption in particular for your book?
Well, mainly because there was a Lutheran priest who lived in this village called Clouster. It's actually got a much longer name than that, but we'll spare you. And the priest's name was John Steingrimson. And he kept an account. He actually kept a sort of a diary of the eruption on a daily basis. And he made notes that were just phenomenal in detail. He was a kind of he's a remarkable man. It's difficult to exactly express how incredibly insightful he was in his descriptions. But he kept this daily journal, and he was in this village where the lava came down on both sides through gorges like great big arms and kind of came around and swept around the village. And he was one of the things he's very famous for was giving what's called the fire mass. It was kind of an exorcism in a way, but the lava was approaching the church, and it looked like it was going to engulf the entire village. And so he gathered all the flock into his church on one Sunday and gave a rip-roaring hellfire and brimstone, literally, sermon. Miraculously, the lava stopped about 2.5 kilometers from the church. But this is where, you know, Steingrimson is kind of a showman. He had noticed before that water flooding onto lava flows could freeze it up, stop it. Sure enough, it did. And you can see that lava flow today just 2.5 or so kilometers from the church. And after that, he was like a rock star. He was famous throughout Iceland.
So this was in, what, 1783? Mm-hmm. And you talk about this guy seeing the lava coming in around his church and so on, but this was presumably happening over days. I mean, tell us what triggered this volcano, and what was this eruption, and what was particularly dramatic about it to pick on?
Well, it began on June the 8th. There were precursors. There were some earthquakes. There was some strange smoke seen in the area. And then on June the 8th, this eruption occurred in the morning around 9 o'clock. And Steingrimson had just stepped out of his house, the rectory where he lived, and was on his way to Clouster. And he happened to look over his shoulder behind him. There was this great wall, black wall. And that was the initial eruption. There were 10. The Lockey eruption was episodic in nature. There were like 10 eruptions over the entire period. And there were like 3 right at the very beginning. And the ground began to zip from the southwest, and it started there, and the lava came down this gorge called, the river was called the Skaftaur, and the gorge was 400 meters deep, and in no time it had filled it up completely. The lava came down very dramatically, and there was a lot of mixing of water and lava, and there was a lot of explosions because of all of which Steingrimson noted to his credit, and thankfully the credit of volcanism in general, because it was one of the first accounts of an eruption as it occurred at that time. So that plus the smoke, the lightning, the ash, all of this made it a very dramatic place to be, and they all thought they were going to die any moment.
How damaging was it?
It was extraordinarily damaging. So first, in Iceland itself, you had about 1/5 of the country died. You only had about 50,000 people in the whole country at the time, and 10,000 of them died. It's one of sort of the major events in Icelandic history that's kind of seared into the country's psyche. Beyond that, though, we can sort of talk about the longer distance effects. Lockey was remarkable not only for the lava and the ash that it put out, but also the gases. So it sent toxic gases pouring across not just Iceland, but also across all of Europe, and they eventually spread all the way across the Northern Hemisphere.
One thing I was really fascinated by in your book is fairly morbid of me, perhaps, but there are so many ways that eruptions can kill you. Take us through them, because it's quite extraordinary, and it must feed into something we can come to later in how you try and use science to mitigate or you know, protect yourselves against these things. How do they get you?
There are lots of ways a volcano can get you. So very few people die from sort of the movie scenario, which is the lava kind of coming after you and setting your legs on fire.
You run from this red-hot lava flow, which is going, I don't know how fast those things go.
Yeah, well, that pretty much never happens. The things that get you are the more ordinary things. the things that sort of get you are, for instance, ash falls. You might be living in a village near a volcano and the ash builds up on your roof and it just collapses and takes out you and all your family. There are the really, really fast moving surges of superheated gas that come surging down the side of a volcano. This happened in Japan in 1991, took out something like 40 volcanologists, photographers, and other tourists who were standing on a ridge watching the eruption, not realizing that they were about to get swallowed up by this massive superheated flow of gas and dust. And then with Laki, for instance, the reason most people ended up dying was from breathing stuff in, breathing in these toxic gases, which aggravated if you had asthma, if you were old, if you had breathing problems, it would cause trouble. It would make you frail. It would make you vulnerable. It could cause cardiopulmonary and other types of deaths. So anything from ash collapsing your building to getting caught in a superheated surge to breathing in gases, there's lots of ways volcanoes can kill you.
So it must get pretty hard to actually work out what the death toll is from an eruption, because you must have this fairly long tail of problems. It's not just those initially killed in the blast. It's all these other people who are killed by, as you say, long-term exposure to the gases, perhaps, and so on.
Right, yeah. We know that 10,000 people died, about 10,000 people died in Iceland, largely from famine because it wiped out so much of the livestock there. And if you've ever been to Iceland, it's still, these villages are isolated, and they were even more isolated back then. And so there was no relying on anybody else outside your district where you lived. And so the hard number there is around 10,000 in Iceland. Outside of that, the gases, the so-called dry fog, made its way across Europe. You had people who, the young, very young, and the old, who had asthma or respiratory problems, or was congestive heart failure, for instance. This would have taken out a lot of people. This was a major pollution event that went on for months, and it just basically polluted the entire surface of Europe, Germany, France, Denmark. And so people who were breathing this stuff in, they were breathing in sulfuric acid, you know, and this would cause breathing problems. Later on in the summertime, when it became inordinately hot there for some reason, no one really knows, and even if the Laki emissions were the result of that or not, but malaria became a problem because of the high heat, the mosquitoes bred in this, and the swamps in around the countryside, and there were deaths from malaria. Then by the time winter came along, winter was extremely harsh, and people froze in the streets or they froze in their houses. So you do, at some point, you say, well, where does the effect of the Laki eruption stop and just natural other effects step in? I mean, you take into account the famines in Egypt and in Japan. The monsoons failed that year because the sea temperatures and the earth temperatures were close to the same. There was no circulation. So then the account goes up, but some people say 2 million, and then there are others who say 6 million if you really want to take in all the indirect effects of the eruption. Had the eruption not happened, then 6 million people might not have died.
We talked about the 2010 eruption, as we'll call it, and I was interested in how that was different to Laki. I mean, we know it in certainly from the UK as a real pain for our travel arrangements, and there were other issues. But how did these two eruptions differ materially?
So the 2010 eruption was really ash-rich. So it was all about the ash, and it was over a very short period of time. So we remember the disruptions when the flights were grounded. But in essence, it was a couple of days stretch when it was putting out the most ash and when flights were grounded. And then it dialed back a bit, and then there was a second round of closures. Laki was an entirely different scale. The sheer amount of lava and gases that it put out swamped the 2010 eruption, swamped Eyjafjallajökull. And remember, Laki went on for 8 months. It started in June. It didn't end until February. So we're not just talking about Monday through Friday when the airports were closed. We're talking about month after month of stuff.
You write in the book about Anja Schmidt and this Leeds-based scientist who estimated that another Laki-style eruption could kill 142,000 people in Europe. And I don't know if you sort of have any issue with her figure, or if you thought that figure made sense, and so on. But it's an extraordinary thing to imagine if that's talking about deaths. And I wondered if science is really helping to come up with any ideas to reduce the impact of these eruptions, or are they just too powerful?
They're not. They are powerful. They are incredibly powerful. But it's actually very interesting how the UK government has been responding to the threat of Icelandic eruptions since 2010. So the work that Anya and others have done have really started to quantify the possible outcomes that could happen if a big eruption went off in Iceland. So the, for instance, the Cabinet Office has added Icelandic eruptions to the official list of things to worry about at night, the National Risk Register. Which is kind of an extraordinary thing to do. It's not every day your risk register thinks about geology. And the British Geological Survey has put out a recent study looking at essentially expanding Anya's work. What would happen if a Laki-style eruption went off tomorrow? Because the government has essentially asked, how can we prepare for the different scenarios? Okay, we know what would happen like in 2010 when Eyjafjallajökull went off. How would we prepare for all that amount of ash? What should we be doing if something as massive as Laki went off tomorrow? And they have a very precise set of recommendations, which I think is really interesting. It's let's put some sulfur dioxide monitors in northern Scotland and stuff like that to get a better sense as to where and how stuff might be spreading from an eruption like Laki. I actually think it's extraordinary how the UK government has responded.
But one of the things that Anya pulls out in her work is that pollution would double, I think, in the first month of an eruption like this. And we saw from this summer over here that pollution had already got to a point where it was on the highest it goes on our scale of 1 to 10, but, you know, with a, maybe a very small amount of help from Saharan dust. But this, a huge eruption, sounds to me as if it would cause a very serious health problem, even just on the pollution side. And I don't know what there is that you can do about that.
There are very practical things that the volcanologists will talk about, things like stocking enough hospital respirators. That's one thing you can say. How that would translate to in actual terms of societal response if something like this began, I'm not sure you can quantify that in terms of respirators. I mean, I think you're talking about, you know, people not just complaining about not being able to get home from Cairo or whatever, but, you know, people's grandmas are going to be in the hospital for a long time.
You can't evacuate an entire continent. It's just not going to happen. You just have to, you know, think about it and be aware of it and, you know, hope for the best, I guess.
How's the science of prediction going? I mean, is it as iffy as the science of predicting earthquakes?
Whether or not Laki's going to go tomorrow is another question. A Laki-style eruption goes off in Iceland about every 200 to 500 years. That's a real kind of general number based on sort of analysis of recent eruptions and how big they are and how much stuff they have put out. So Laki was 230 years ago. Are we overdue for a Laki-style eruption? It's not that simplistic. I mean, as you know, volcanoes don't erupt on process and to schedule, but I would say that scientists are getting a lot better at understanding the signals that come before a big eruption, and that if something big like Laki were to happen, we would certainly know about it in advance. We would feel its heartbeat picking up. We might sniff some gases coming out, and we would know that it was coming.
Is there anything you can do to prevent them? I mean, you talk in the book again about how teams in Cameroon, for example, had vented off gases that had built up under the bottom of really deep lakes and had been lethal in the past is when that gas had come up. Can you go in and say the pressure under this volcano is enormous and it's surely only a matter of time? Can you just bomb it or something and say at least you have control over when it goes off?
People have had all sorts of crazy ideas like that, and none of them have been shown to ever actually work. In Hawaii in the 1940s, the U.S. military tried to bomb a lava flow that was threatening the city of Hilo. And the lava flow did stop, but it was just because the eruption ceased around the same time. So the military can't really take credit for that.
So if you were gambling people and you had to put money on which one was going to go next, which would you put your finger on?
Hecla.
Okay, media scare. There we go. Tell us a little bit about Hecla.
Hecla was the gateway to hell in medieval times. It's one of Iceland's most active volcanoes. It's this beautiful, gorgeous single volcano rising out of the countryside. It's not like Laki, which is sort of a low row of cones. Hecla is your classic big snowy mountaintop. And when it erupts, you get this lovely plume of ash coming out of it. The reason we think it's going to go next is because it's got more magma under it than it had before it last erupted. It erupted in 2000, and now, because this is one of these volcanoes that is instrumented so well, they know that the magma chamber is not really overly full, but there's more magma down there than there was before it erupted in 2000. So if I'm going to put money on anything, this is probably a bad thing to say, but if I'm going to put money on anything, I'd say Hekla.
Does this instrumentation calm people's nerves at all, or does it really mean that you know that you're going to face doom rather than you can do anything about it?
The latter. You know you're going to face doom. Yeah. Do you want to know it's coming or not?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a psychological quandary, an existential question.
But it's really interesting to compare it to things like earthquakes, which you cannot predict, and you don't know that earthquakes are coming. With volcanoes, you at least get some warning. It tells you it's about to happen. You can do things, even if it's just get in your car and drive farther away. So,
Alex, some scientists will talk about geoengineering projects where they want to almost emulate some of the effects of volcanic eruptions by meaning the sort of putting a load of sulfur dioxide particles into the atmosphere. How much did this eruption at Laki do to cool the atmosphere locally?
Well, it was an awful lot of sulfur. So it was 120 million tons of sulfur put into the atmosphere. And these particles, as you mentioned, cool the Earth by reflecting back sunlight. And it cooled the Northern Hemisphere by more than a degree for a couple of years. That's stronger than the cooling effect that we saw at Pinatubo in 1991, if you remember that eruption in the Philippines.
120 megatons of sulfur dioxide translates into about 240 megatons of sulfuric acid. So you really don't want to have that up in the air and breathe, because it has very harsh effects on vegetation. Leaves fall off. It's not good for crops. It's not good for people. So you don't want that to be sustained. It does cause cooling, but the cooling probably wouldn't last more than a few years. And that's about it. And as far as applying this to, say, geoengineering, let's pump all this stuff up there, I think it's a bad idea. Because if you think about like the butterfly effect, you know, where a butterfly over here causes a rainstorm over there, that's very true. And I don't think we know enough about the intricacies of the climate right now. We're in a stage where we're reacting to the climate. We're seeing temperatures rise and that sort of thing. But the causations and the mechanisms are still pretty much vague, and I wouldn't want to monkey around with it.
Thanks both for coming into the studio. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Island on Fire is published by Profile Books and out now in hardback. That's all we have for you on Science Weekly today. Remember, if there's a volcanic eruption, day or night, to understand what's going on, just go to the best news site on the web, theguardian.com/science. Join us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Science Weekly. But from me, Ian Sample, and producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.